The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Hey, it's Jack Stein in for Mr. Dory Monson this afternoon. Big lead of the day is going to be QFC to close. We got to get deep into that and much more all coming up in this hour.
The Big Lead, Big Local.
So this literally just broke. This literally just came out. Literally. Should say that one more time. For immediate release, QFC is going to close two Seattle stores. Quality Food Corners today announced the closure of two underperforming stores in Seattle. That's a decision accelerated by a new Seattle City Council mandate that requires certain employers to provide extra pay for some, but not for all, city frontline workers. Now, this is going back to that $4 hero pay, is what they call it, or the $2 hero pay, depending on where you are. They say, our business provides affordable groceries, good jobs, with growth opportunities to thousands of Seattle residents, and proudly supports thousands of local community organizers. We need a level playing field to deliver on these commitments. Unfortunately, Seattle City Council did not consider that grocery stores, even in a pandemic, operate on razor-thin profit margins in a very competitive landscape. So this is the key to the whole thing. You hear this a lot from people who have a hard time with economics, and they say, well, why can't the fat cats at the top in the corporate office just go ahead and pay the little guy down at the bottom? That's not the way that works. Businesses operate in margins. Look at the way that a restaurant operates. Very, very thin margins. Food goes bad. People don't show up. Maybe you have a good week one time, a terrible week the other time. Business is an ever-changing, ever-shifting idea. You simply just can't say, okay, now everybody gets $4 more, $2 more, or whatever it is. So this is a problem. For as much as I like Senator Sanders, this is one of the problems that I don't think that he understands either, that when you go around and you tell people that they have to have a $15 minimum wage, you can't apply that equally to all industries, to all businesses, because they operate it at different levels, within different margins. So you have the city council coming along and saying, you know what, we're going to do hero pay for all these people, which would be great. It would be great if that could happen. But you would have to subsidize it. And that means that you'd have to tax people more to then pay those companies to pay people more. It makes no sense whatsoever. So they go on to say, when you factor in the increased costs of operating during COVID-19, coupled with consistent financial losses at these two locations, and this new extra pay mandate, it becomes impossible to operate a financially sustainable business. And that is from the company. The two affected store locations will remain open and operational for 60 days through April 24th until the closure process is complete. This includes one at 416th 15th Avenue and 8435th Avenue. And it's a sad day for those people, because I'm curious if they would want the extra, whatever it is, $2 or $4 in hero pay, or they would want their jobs. And this has happened many times across the country. This happened down in Long Beach about 2 weeks ago, down in Long Beach, California. The exact same circumstance happened. So they say the extra pay is in addition to the total compensation package QFC currently offers to its associates, including competitive wages, comprehensive health care, and a reliable pension. QFC's average hourly wage in Seattle is about $20 an hour, and a total compensation is over $25 an hour, including healthcare and pension benefits. So you could say they're getting hero pay already. You could say that they're making a pretty decent living for someone who's working at a grocery store. This is the problem with these policies is that they sound good. It sounds good to give somebody more money. Everybody wants everybody to have more money, but businesses don't operate like that. And then people accuse you of being cold-hearted when you say that. You say, "Oh, you don't want that. You want the guy to stay down there." You don't. No, I want everybody to rise equally. I want everybody to have the same opportunities. And now you are actively destroying businesses in the pursuit of what? In the pursuit of what? I would ask the city council. They go on to say the city council's misguided mandate targets one industry, and not only oversteps our collective bargaining rights, but it altogether exempts several non-union competitors. City Council and the mayor's refusal to answer why their proposal does nothing to raise wages for the city's own frontline workers, who are serving with the same dignity and determination as our own associates. Unfortunately, The irreparable harm that will come to workers in our Seattle community is a direct result of the city's attempt to pick winners and losers among essential businesses and workers. And that is exactly right. Think about it like this. The COVID-19 pandemic has created an artificial landscape of winners and losers, where if you are a small business owner, and again, you're competing in those margins, really difficult to operate, you're operating in this really kind of hectic, dynamic situation. And then all of a sudden, you can't operate your business anymore, or your business drops by something like 75%. You can't operate at full capacity anymore. Your business is going to shut down. But who can operate? Who has the capital to keep going? It's big box stores. Big box stores, they keep going. Places like Target, places like Costco. Everybody in the middle is just kind of being shut out. And then if you think about it, when everybody gets their fund stimulus check, where are they going to go? That fund stimulus, everyone's going to get $2,000 or $1,400. Where's everybody going to go? I doubt that they're going to go to small businesses. I think that they're going to try to get the most for their money, and they are going to go to the big box stores. Nicole, tell me I'm off base about this. Tell me that, because I want this to not be true. I want this to be the kind of circumstance where you can pay people more money. You can give people more money, but I just don't see it working out like that.
No, I'm with you. I think that's we've talked about this before, but you're right. It has created these winners and losers. We label people essential or non-essential. And so it's created this winners and losers. And you're right. They won't spend that extra money in small businesses because they don't leave their houses, right? And those are mostly, you know, places you can go online, Amazon, Target, Walmart. And no, I agree. I think Seattle stores were already struggling, and then adding
already
on this,
struggling
like, mandatory extra $4 is not going to help keep businesses in Seattle.
When we look at, again, the $15 minimum wage, I think a lot of people just think, oh, well, that's the company is going to do that. Oh, the company will just be paying people $15 an hour. That's not the way it's going to work. So what's going to happen is that those companies are they're going to default to the government, and they're going to say, can you subsidize us? Because we simply can't. We can't meet it. We can't meet these pay rates. Otherwise, we're going to have to close. And the government's going to come in and they say, well, we can't lose this entire industry. Of course, we're going to subsidize it. Of course, we're going to just dump tons of money so that you can pay people $15 an hour. And then those people get taxed. It is a grift. This is the way that the money just cycles from you to government and then back to you. It is a grift. Because everybody thinks that $15 an hour sounds good. I think it sounds great. I would love for somebody to be able to go and find a business where they could make $15 an hour at the federal level. That would be fantastic. But that's not always the case across the country. And anything other than that is just this misguided attempt to make people feel good without looking at the ramifications of your actions. Speaking of, Mayor Jenny Durkan has decided she gave her fourth and final State of the City address yesterday evening by calling for continued vigilance against COVID-19, highlighting the challenges facing the city and giving a glimpse of hope on the horizon. She called the COVID-19 pandemic, which has claimed the lives of 4,000 Washingtonians since March 2020, the challenge of our lifetime. Nicole, I believe we have a clip of Mayor Durkan speaking about this.
We will begin to recover and rebuild more equitably. Thank you. And please remember, mask up and stay safe.
Oh, man. So she goes on and on and on, and she goes on about her time and working for the city, and she says the Washington Health Department has vaccinated 1,057,844 people statewide as of February 10th. The state is averaging 26,761 vaccinations per day. This is a miracle, by the way. I know we were talking about the coronavirus earlier in the show, and we were talking about vaccinations and what that means, but this is a miracle of modern science. And yet we're still being told that this is the biggest issue of all time, where we all need to continue to live in fear and continue to be locked down. She said vaccination is the path to healing and recovering and reopening. That's how we beat this virus and how we reopen our businesses and schools. I really wish that Mayor Durkan had listened to me back in June, I believe, is when I said, listen, Mayor Durkan, I was on, you know, five nights out of the week. I was saying, Mayor Durkan, please. Just keep everything open, open everything back up, let kids go back to school, and we can all work through this together. But instead, she did the exact opposite of my advice. And it is this, I'm seeing more and more with what's going around in the country with just bad COVID policy. And then people like Mayor Durkan or whomever else, they leave. they do a bad job and then they leave. And then they just, okay, well, you get to continue living your life. But what about all of the people that you have left behind, that your bad policies have resulted in? How many businesses, Nicole? Like last week, it was 160 businesses deciding that they were just going to leave.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of that is not enforcing any laws, so people can steal anything they want and not see any punishment for that. And then also businesses that are trying to operate, get things taken from them, and they can't get insurance because insurances don't want to cover Seattle businesses. So there's nothing working in the favor of these businesses that are trying to operate in Seattle.
There's, and so you have all these businesses, they have, the city council isn't backing them up, the mayor isn't backing them up, you have police officers where the city council is actively working against them, the mayor's not backing them up. Mayor Durkan left Seattle worse than when she came into the position. But it's not, I don't think we should be afraid of just coming out and saying it, that she has left it worse than when she found it. Now, she'll go on and she'll have a political career and she'll be able to live her life. But the real world ramifications of her decisions, just the destruction of Seattle, is astounding. And yet this article and the speech that she gave doesn't match up to that whatsoever. I'm not reading about her saying, oh, I'm so sorry for all my poor decisions, because she can't do it. She wants to continue to have a career in politics and go, I don't know, maybe she wants to run for governor. Maybe she wants to run for some kind of Senate seat. Maybe she wants to have that kind of position. And she'll fail upwards, and we will all be left with terrible policy and terrible decisions. However, there are people, out there who are talking about how to fix the big issues in Seattle, primarily being the homeless problem, which is I'm very passionate about, because I hate to see my brothers and sisters living on the streets, and I don't think that people should be allowed to live that way. And there was an article that came out from the Seattle Times in which they are talking to Jason Johnson, and he's the former homeless director, and he's basically talking about why they spend so much money without any kind of a fix. It's $165 million. And he says, the article goes on and on. I recommend that people read it. But he says, with 12,000 people experiencing homelessness in our county, it was evident that the level of investment that the city was making wasn't enough. It still is not enough. And study after study, I think, is most telling, is a study by McKinsey, who showed that we need hundreds of millions more dollars for housing units across the county, not just the city of Seattle. And not just from the city of Seattle, but from our system as a whole. And reading this was very enlightening to me, because you can see that Seattle in particular is bearing the brunt of a tremendous homeless population, and no one else is contributing. And how can one county in particular, or one city in particular, bear the brunt of the almost the entirety of the homeless population? Nicole, what say you?
Well, I just would say that they don't spend the money correctly either, though. So I do see them bearing the brunt of it, because that's where it's the most out of control, or it's the most visual, obviously, to people that drive through Seattle, that work in Seattle. And
right.
But also, it's not being spent wisely. They just keep asking for more money, keep throwing more money at it.
Exactly.
They've done multiple studies spending all this money on these studies. And then they don't take the advice of the people they ask for advice from. So there's a lot of issues. But I will agree that they bear the brunt of it, but they also have not earned the trust of people giving them money. So that's why I think people tend to want to, funnel it through people like the Union Gospel Mission, things like that, because you can see how they spend the money. You can see them
right. Trying
to help these people. They have rules when they come to them, that type of thing. But we just hand it over, and it's not getting better. The way that they're spending it now, it's not helping the problem. So that money needs to be spent differently in order to actually see results, because I agree that people should not be living on the streets. I would love to help all of them, but people have to be held accountable for the money we're spending on it.
So Johnson goes on to say, to your point, Nicole, he says, what is not working is that providers and advocates have their own relationships with members of city council. And so budget after budget after budget is approved with these sort of pet projects. And sometimes even the continued funding of projects that fail to meet standards through a request for proposals. And that's where we see the problem. So again, this is just money going to programs that aren't working, that aren't meeting their standards. And yet, because people have particular relationships with members of the council, they get what they want. I'm unsure if, you know, we talk about low information voters. How could you not live in Seattle and recognize that the city council is doing a poor job, less than a poor job? They're doing the worst job that you possibly could. How could you not see that Jenny Durkin did a terrible job handling COVID-19? Why would you continue to vote for that person? I think the reason that people continue to vote like that, I've just been running this through in my mind just for the country in general. Why do we continue to vote for people that we know do not have a good track record, that we know have bad policies, that we know aren't exactly the deepest intellectually or philosophical individuals? Why do we keep doing that? And I think it's because some of the people that we've elected have honed in on the rhetoric machine to a point where they can just pump feel-good feelings right into your brain. They can just hit all the right notes in the right order, and then you say, yeah, I'll vote for that individual. Again, your low-information voter who thinks that the idea of let's just say, socialism, oh, yeah, this sounds like a fine idea to me. I have no issues with it whatsoever. And then when those policies don't work, they don't question it. They say, oh, well, there's someone else who's preventing this from working. There's something else out there that's preventing this from working. People have to wake up and they have to see what's going on in their own community, I think, in a really real and visceral way. Nicole, for example, you were telling me that you can't even walk around your neighborhood anymore. I've heard that from producers. I've heard that from other hosts. It's amazing to me that you have people who have the courage to say, I can't live in my neighborhood anymore. And everyone goes, homeless problem's not that bad, dude.
Well, I was saying that 3 years ago, I lived downtown Seattle and I would walk every day and I did not fear it. And I would not ever sign a lease on that place again. I would not live down there because it would scare right. me to walk from my car to my apartment down there now. So I know that there are, you know, some safer areas and whatnot of where I live. I had no problems with it 3 years ago, but that's how far downhill it's gone.
Jack Stein, I'm sitting in for Mr. Dory Monson this afternoon. We have to take a really quick break. When we get back, Jay Inslee is going to be on the... Well, I'm not going to be talking to him, but we're going to be hearing from Jay Inslee. Take a real quick break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, sitting in for Dory Monson this afternoon. Just waiting on Inslee. Waiting on Inslee to come on in and give his live press conference about the schools, what's going on with that. I came across this story. It's kind of starting to become a little bit viral, but Oregon is promoting a teacher program that seeks to undo racism in mathematics. Now, you might be saying to yourself, I hate math. I want nothing to do with math. And you'd be right, but the idea that math is racist is something that I had never heard of previously. So they have a toolkit, is what they're calling it, which includes a list of ways white supremacy culture allegedly infiltrates math classrooms. I did not know. Like, I knew that we could all be woke. I knew that there was a level of woke that one could aspire to. But this is transcendental wokeness. When you are finding white supremacy in esoteric symbols, when you are finding it in numbers and equate, that is a fascinating. It's almost they've reached the level of nirvana in wokeness that I could not possibly hope to find. The Oregon Department of Education, ODE, recently encouraged teachers to register for training that encourages ethno-mathematics and argues, among other things, that white supremacy manifests itself in the focus on finding the right answer. An ODE newsletter sent last week advertises a February 21st Pathway to Math Equality micro course, which is designed for middle school teachers to make use of a toolkit for dismantling racism in mathematics. The event website identifies the event as a partnership between California's San Mateo County Office of Education. This is just nonsense. It is just unbelievable nonsense. They're talking about the concept of mathematics being purely purely objective is unequivocally false, and teaching it even as much less so. The document for Equitable Math Toolkit reads, upholding the idea that there are always right and wrong answers perpetuate objectivity as well as the fear of open conflict. What? I'm under the impression that math is either correct or incorrect. I don't know about you. I spent a lot of time in elementary school having this exact same argument with my teachers, saying, no, but this is the answer. And they would say, no, this is the correct way to do mathematics. To say that it is somehow causing open conflict between people, fear of open conflict, and that there is such a thing as a right and a wrong answer. If I have two fingers on one hand and two fingers on the other hand, what does that add up to? Nicole, please enlighten me. I need to know. what point in time? Two and two.
Oh, you want me to actually answer four?
Oh, well, we got to dismantle white supremacy live on air. Apparently, this is what we have to do. Two and two is what?
I've been taught four.
Mm-hmm. How dare you? How dare mm-hmm. you spread white supremacy on these airwaves? How dare you come out here with your privilege talking about mathematics as if you can even quantify something like that? So an associated dismantling racism workbook linked within the toolkit similarly identifies objectivity described as the, quote, belief that there is such a thing as being objective or, quote, unquote, neutral as a characteristic of white supremacy. So this is postmodern thinking. If you've never really been faced with postmodern thinking, I am well versed in it. I have a degree in it. So when you're talking about postmodern thinkers, people like Foucault or Lacan or any of these kind of French philosophers, they had this idea that if you broke something down to its absolute smallest piece, you could find the truth of it, right? Or the quote unquote truth. And so this is what they're doing right here, is they're saying, well, there is nothing really objective and everything's just kind of relative. And if you try to make something objective, that is an example of white supremacy. That link to me is so astounding that at this point, it's almost as if they're just sitting in a room, like all the kind of woke people out there, the woke commission at woke headquarters. And they've got one of those plastic boards, one of those wooden cord boards, and they've got darts. And they've got 3x5 cards, and they're just throwing the darts at the wall. And they say, well, we need something else to complain about. What could we complain about, and where could we complain about it? And one guy throws the dart, and it hits Oregon. And they go, okay, well, what do they got in Oregon? Another guy throws the dart, it hits elementary schools. Okay, perfect. Something's going on. Oregon, elementary schools. One guy throws the dart, it hits white supremacy. Okay, Oregon, elementary school, white supremacy. One guy throws the dart, it hits math. Boom. That's what it is. That's the thing we have to go after. Math is now all about white supremacy. This is why if I have kids, homeschooled. I will not subject my children, my non-existent children, to this brain-rotting nonsense where now you have children who are being told that math is an ethnocentric construction. Identify and challenge the ways that math is used to uphold capitalist, imperialist, and racist views. This is a bridge too far. If you are a sane human being and your child is going to the school, please pull them out immediately. Nicole, if you had children.
Hey, really quick. I think it's at least beginning.
Oh, there we go. He's just sitting down. What's he doing, Sean? Is he just...
Yeah, I'm on a bit of a delay with you guys. I'm off.
Good afternoon.
Oh, there
it's
he
really
is.
A beautiful day in the state of Washington. We have some good news. Actually, on a number of fronts. First off, we have good news that we are opening our schools for in-person instruction. And this is such good news for our students. We know that in-person instruction is the best way to do instruction. It's best for the teachers. It's best for the students. It's best for the parents. And we know that this can be done safely. And the great news today I can share with people is that we are increasing the number of days that our students can have in-person instruction. We already have over 200,000 students who are today receiving at least some significant in-person instruction. And that is increasing every single day. And the reason it is increasing every single day is that we are learning that we can do this with safety, and we are learning we can do this safely all over the state of Washington. We have over 175 schools that are already doing this. They are doing this safely. They are doing this efficiently. And they are doing this with a resounding confidence that this is the best way to educate our children, while at the same time giving parents an option to remain in a remote setting should they desire to remain in that kind of situation. This is tremendous news for our state. We know that educating kids is tough in general, and our educators have been doing a superhuman job remotely, trying to get the attention of second graders, trying to keep third graders on task. And they've been as creative as possible. But all over the state of Washington, we are now returning to the way we know best, which is in-person instruction. Now, why have we been able to do this? We have been led by excellent educators. Our educators have been sort of like Lewis and Clark. They have been the explorers, the ones that went back to classes in person, have shown us how to do this. They've shown us that when our kids and staff wear masks, where they socially distance, where they have decent attention to ventilation, that this can be done safely. And we ought to be thankful for the educators, not just teachers, but engineers, bus drivers, nutritional experts, counselors, parents, who have demonstrated the protocols necessary to make this safe. And we are thankful to them to show the way. And we are very happy that their colleagues now are looking at the experience that they have had, learning from their experience, and adopting those best practices in many places across the state of Washington. Now, we are not alone in this experience in the United States. It actually is becoming quite common. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control released updated school reopening guidance. And that guidance broadly aligns with what we are suggesting in the state of Washington. They basically have said unequivocally that if we have strong health and safety measures, returning to school is a safe thing to be able to be done if we pay attention to some of these safety protocols. And I think that the CDC, in effect, has confirmed what our educators have discovered, which is that this can be done safely. The CDC also made very clear that mass vaccination of our teachers is not a prerequisite to going back to school. And I look forward to when we have our essential workers, including teachers, grocery clerks, bus drivers, police and fire, child care workers, all can get their vaccination. But what we have demonstrated and what the CDC has confirmed is that we can have on-site education in a safe and effective way. And this is really great news for all of us. We need to continue this movement in this effort because we still have thousands of students who have had a difficult time in remote learning despite the tremendous work of their educators. And we've been working with our local departments of health and our state department of health to share tools to be made available to schools so that they can have increasing confidence to return to school settings. So today, to that end, today we are expanding the COVID testing assistance that we could provide to schools and school districts. This is part of our ongoing effort to give more students the option to return to in-person instruction. And it obviously increases access to testing, both for educators and students. The Department of Health has developed this testing pilot program during the last year, has been in place for 13 school districts. And it has become part of our playbook for returning our students to classes. So about 50 more school districts will now be participating in this volunteer program starting this month, and we hope these numbers will grow. It is not necessary to get back to school, but it's a way to help build confidence where educators, parents would like to have those confidence measures in place. So we're very happy about this. Finances should not be a problem here, because in part because of federal funding and in part because of state, Our schools will shortly be receiving hundreds of millions of dollars that will be available for testing protocols and a variety of other needs of our school system. So this is yet another layer of confidence that we want to offer people to go back to InSight classes. Now, as part of this playbook, each district will also have the support of the Health Commons Project. This is a Washington State nonprofit that is committed to accelerating equitable education of our students. And they do an excellent job of working with local agencies to help with care services and delivering testing services where they're needed most. They do this by recruiting labor, making sure capital is available, although that should not be a problem, and accessing the best science and technology to fit the needs and the desires of the district to available testing. And they're going to lend their expertise to schools to provide a testing planner to school districts that participate in this program to directly design a program for the schools that want them. Now, testing strategies are just part of our playbook. We're also helping school districts adapt to the rules that COVID controls that we have put in place as well. Based on federal guidance, as well as what we've learned through our local school district action, the state has developed what we're calling the Learn to Return playbook. It's a public resource on how schools can get this job done. This playbook also includes health and safety requirements, of course, including universal masking, social distancing, and ventilation. And altogether, these things, I believe, will build confidence, as they already have, in our communities about in-person learning. Now, we know this, returning to school is not just important for our students' academic development. Schools provide nutrition and many other services that kids can't get at home. People from poor and more rural communities struggle with remote access, and we know that despite our best efforts, that has remained the fact, whether it's because of lack of broadband or lack of support at home. Now, if these students can safely return to class, and the science says unequivocally that they can, we should, I believe, feel a sense of urgency to answer this paramount duty to our students. I know we all feel that. I know we have all the same desire. I know we've all had concerns about this pandemic. But now we have been armed with something very powerful, and that is knowledge and experience that we did not have a year ago. We have the knowledge of how to do this safely, and that knowledge has been given to us by our educators, our professionals, who have developed ways to do this safely in person, and we thank them for that guidance. I've seen this successful return to in-school programs throughout the state of Washington. As I said, there's over 175 school districts now doing this safely. I was at Elk Ridge Elementary School in Buckley 2 weeks ago. I wanted to tour Wenatchee High School last week, but we got caught in a snowstorm. But I did meet virtually with Wenatchee educators and staff and students and custodial staff last Friday. The photos you're seeing are from school districts that have returned to schools safely. That includes schools in Meridian, Moses Lake, Natchez Valley, Port Angeles, and White River. So we have demonstrated that this can be done throughout the state of Washington. It is being done throughout the state of Washington safely. To share a couple observations that I've heard, and I think my role here is just to provide information for people that they can use when they make their own decisions. A teacher I met at Elk Ridge Elementary, he actually I believe is a high school teacher, he told me that when his district was considering going back to in-person learning, he really didn't think that was a good idea. He just didn't think the problems could be surmounted. But then he went over and visited a high school in Yakima, and he saw how the mitigation measures were being implemented. And that gave him confidence, because basically what he said was, what I saw was, is if you go to a hybrid model where you have your only about half of your students in the classroom at a given time, you can spread out. You can do some cohorting. You can keep people separated. And students actually are remarkably adept at wearing masks. They've actually been very successful in this regard. So he returned to his school, and now he's been involved in the White River district very successfully with a high degree of confidence. So when I've talked to educators, I've heard, you know, a recognition of why it's easier to do education in person. But I haven't heard anyone demonstrate how it is impossible to do that. And I'm just very heartened by that. And again, I want to thank educators for their leadership in this regard. We know that there's nothing with zero risk in this world. But we know that we now have the necessary tools to mitigate that risk. And I've been very impressed with the discipline that educators have shown and students. And we know that where people have had communication between educators and the staff, the people who have been solution-oriented have found a way forward. And it's taken a lot of listening to one another. And we're just very encouraged that that's going on across the state of Washington right now so that we can improve education of our students. So today I've asked some experts in the field. I'm joined by Enumclaw School District Superintendent Sean Carey and Health Commons Project Manager Sarah Sutton. So, Sean, could you give us some of your insights?
Good afternoon, Governor Lindsley. It's my pleasure to be here today. And yes, I am the very proud superintendent of the Enumclaw School District, and just excited to be here. I will let you know that, and you probably already know this, we are a school district that's located in Southeast King County, and we serve approximately 4,000 students across 9 schools. We are extremely excited that roughly 80% of our students are back in our schools. And successfully, they've been successful here for the last over 1 month. It's wonderful to see our kids in person.
All right. Well, that was an illuminating and very educational 9 minutes of my life that I will never get back. And I have nothing but appreciation. Just trying to keep level. We attack ideas and not people. Right? We go after ideas and not people. And so I would like to thank Jay Inslee for literally bleeding 9 minutes of my life away from me that I will never get back. I will never be able to experience
this. Jack, this is a different Inslee. I mean, considering all of the press conferences, you know, from March of last year on, him saying, you know, kids shouldn't be returning to school, I appreciate the flip here. He is saying, this is ridiculous. Get them back in school. Stop arguing with us. This is what science says. So I agree with that. And I will say that it is nice to see him. I mean, you know, I know that he's not running anymore and he doesn't care anymore who's on his side at this point, I guess. But yeah, he is not backing down when it comes to fighting the teachers unions here that are set on them not going back.
I wonder if something happened, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks ago, some big event that happened like 3 weeks ago, like it's where somebody left office,
yeah, right?
And then somebody else became, geez, I mean, if I can only think about some event that happened. I'm Jack Stein.
Almost a month ago.
A month ago. That's right. That's when everything changed. That's when all the new data came out. I'm Jack Stein filling in for Dory Monson. Been a pleasure. He will be back tomorrow. If you want to find more of my content, Human Genius is the YouTube channel and the podcast. Subscribe, enjoy. Nicole, always a pleasure. I will see you guys next time.
I'm not even supposed to be here today.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.